Reading from page 616, day 22. Pabanga Dojichang gave us a short talk in order to set our motivations. Glorious Chandrakriti said, "The King of Swans spreads his broad white wings. One relative, one of suchness, and flying at the head of its flock, propelled by strong winds of virtue, he crosses the lake of good qualities to the supreme shore of the victors. That is, with two types of bodhicitta, the relative and ultimate forms, together with two collections, you will reach the level of the victorious ones. You must study how to do this." He then reviewed the above headings on the way to train for mental questions by cultivating the five or six prerequisites. The actual way to go about achieving the five pitfalls, the way to cultivate the antidotes, and so on. The first mental state is achieved through the power of study, the second through the power of contemplation, the third and fourth are achieved through the power of memory, both the fifth and sixth come through the power of vigilance. The seventh and eighth are achieved through the power of perseverance, the ninth through the power of familiarity. I've already dealt with this in more detail in the above sections that discuss the nine mental states individually. How there are four types of mental process. The first two mental states are a forced type of fixation. The next five are an interrupted type of fixation. The eighth state is an uninterrupted form of fixation involving some effort. The ninth is a spontaneous, effortless form of fixation. Each of these mental processes is distinguished by the following features. Both the first and second mental states are chiefly dullness and excitement with hardly any single-pointed concentration. They are not considered worth labeling interrupted or even uninterrupted single-pointed concentration. At this stage, you must force yourself into these mental states through vigilance and memory. While it is not the case that you do not need to force yourself into the next five mental states by vigilance and memory, your single-pointed concentration does become progressively more stable. Thus, the mental process here is one of interrupted fixation, because your mental state is being interrupted by dullness and excitement. In the eighth state, you apply a little of the antidote of effort at the beginning of the session. The rest of the session is uninterrupted by excitement or dullness. In the ninth, you effortlessly evoke the visualization, thus the fixation is spontaneous. The way true mental quiescence develops from this point, when you reach the ninth state, your single-pointed concentration is free of subtle dullness and excitement. You are able to remain in this state effortlessly for long periods, and yet this state is not true mental quiescence. It only resembles it. In order to achieve true mental quiescence, you must meditate single-pointedly again and again to gain further familiarity with it. You must then attain the exceptional bliss that comes with mental and physical suppleness. Mental suppleness is the first of the two types to develop, but the bliss due to physical suppleness is the first of the two blisses to develop. The deleterious energy winds within the body are pacified, and you feel comfortable, although you feel a kind of pressure in the scalp or brain, rather like the sensation of a warm hand touching your newly shaven head. You immediately pacify the deleterious states of mind that stand in the way of carrying out any of the virtue you may wish to perform. You have developed mental suppleness. You then develop physical suppleness as a result of this mental suppleness, and the energy winds are now adapted and circulating throughout the body. The body is now free of any deleterious states and feels no discomfort while you perform victorious, virtuous practices. It can be put to any use you want. The body is supple and as light as cotton wool. You thus experience great bliss from this physical suppleness, and the body has extremely blissful natural physical sensations. Sorry. Reading from page 619. We are told of an example of this. One practitioner, after taking many pains, remained for many years in the peak of existence meditative absorption. The rats ate off his long hair. Later he noticed this and lost his temper. His dhyana concentration declined and he went to the lower realms. When you achieve excellent mental quiescence, you experience such clarity of mind that you can even count the atoms in walls, etc. Whenever any of these 10 signs appear before you, that is the 5 objects of the senses, external visual form, for example, the 3 poisons, man, women, you will recall their drawbacks and come to dislike them. You will develop fever delusions, and those you to develop will be weaker. You will develop good qualities, such as thinking. You are combining your single-pointed concentration with your sleep, because this stability is so solid. These days, there are people who pretend they seek the view found in the Mam Mudra or Dzogchen teachings by referring to short and simplistic texts instead of relying on great classics. Such people will find it difficult to achieve anything of real value discussed in the classics, even common mental quiescence, for example. Yet we share mental quiescence with non-Buddhists. According to the root text of the Mam Mudra, observation of the conscious walking of the mind is said merely to acquaint you with the relative truth of the mind. So you may think your meditations along these lines are sound, but it is like believing a lump of brass to be gold. You deserve only to wander aimlessly on wrong paths. You may increase your dullness and mistake this for meditation, but such meditation will not even precipitate your rebirth in the higher realms. You will merely create the cause for rebirth, as for example an animal. Reading from page 620. How to train in the very essence of wisdom, special insight. This has 3 subheadings: ascertaining the non-existence of a personal self, and ascertaining the non-existence of a self phenomena. Then the way you develop special insight. How to develop the absorption resembling space. Here there are 4 key points to be determined. What is to be refuted? What are the full set of possibilities? How the self and the aggregates cannot be truly the same? How the self and the aggregates cannot be truly different? After achieving very stable mental quiescence, you do not meditate on things like the special insight found in worldly paths to the gross mental peace. This would only suppress manifest delusions. The thing we most yearn for is liberation, so we must develop the supramundane type of special insight that analyzes the meaning of selflessness. This will sever the root of cyclic existence for us. Were we to develop such insight, we would systematically prevent all the bands of cyclic existence without ever having to resort to any special meditation in the higher planes. As it said in praise to the praiseworthy, all the people who follow your doctrine do not gain the actual dhyana planes, they prevent their rebirth existence, while Mara looks on helplessly. Thus we must ascertain what is meant by profound emptiness. If we gain no realization into it, it is quite impossible to gain liberation, and even the other attacks of a child, of the victorious ones, would only become something associated with grasping at dualistic signs. If you have any part of the combination of method and wisdom, you will not be able to travel to the state of a victorious one. You will be like a bird with only one wing. The method is bodhicitta, wisdom is emptiness. You must not train in one without the other, just as Jizongpa said. If you do not have the wisdom that understands the way things exist, you cannot eradicate the rules of existence. Despite acquaintance with renunciation and bodhicitta, thus work hard at the means to realize interdependence. Sorry. Although while still tending to believe in emptiness, you may have some doubts, this emptiness will tear to shreds your grasping at the self. It is like a hailstorm flattening crops. The 400 verses say, even those with few merits have no doubts about this dharma. Even those who still have their doubts will tear existence to tatters. Now this practice is something that also has its necessary prerequisites. In order to develop the correct view in your mindstream, you must have all the following causes and prerequisites. You should devote yourself to a holy being who has correct understanding of the key points of the scriptures, and you should obtain from him instruction on emptiness. You should also accumulate your collection and purify your obscurations. His Holiness was commenting on the respect to the presence, in the presence of the five masters from Nagarjuna, Aryadeva, and so on, where Lama Tsongkhapa had dreamed that one of the masters, Buddha Palita, kept a book on his hand. And that was the time when he realized the emptiness soon after that. Reading from page 623, the second para, there were many different versions of the new among the four schools of tenets asserted in the noble land of India, but foremost among these views is that put forward by Prasangika Madhyamikas. They were the only ones to explain that meaning of interdependent origination is emptiness, while the meaning of emptiness is interdependent origination. Our compassionate teacher taught at various levels for disciples with inferior to superior mentalities. Hence, he first taught that the person is empty of substantial and autonomous existence. He did this in order to prevent his disciples from clinging to a personal self. To his disciples with better minds, he made the distinction between phenomena that truly exist and those that do not. To people with even better minds, he taught that phenomena do not truly exist, but that they can be established by their natures. To those with still better minds, he taught that all phenomena by nature do not exist. This last version is the best and the Bhagavan's ultimate thought on the matter. Sorry. As our teacher himself said, a most famous and glorious monk, born in the land of Baita in the south, who will be named Naga, will destroy nihilism and substantialism. The protector, Nagarjuna, is here predicted as the peerless interpreter of the thoughts of Victorious One on how to abandon the extremes of nihilism and substantialism. Thus we must seek the view by following in his footsteps. Many are the view that are newly fabricated by people, mere whim that had been declared to be profound, but the ultimate view accords with Nagarjuna's thoughts, and it is certain that to alter them is to apply to the stupid Tibetans. People like the great Indian scholar Acharya Baba Viveka and the greater Tibetan Chonangpa Pandits were mistaken about the key points of the view. There were also others who followed Nagarjuna but did not understand his thinking. There were even those who did not only depend on the philosophical system of Nagarjuna and his successors, and who teach views they themselves invented and that fall outside his system. Sorry for the interruption. Chandrakriti says paths other than those Acharya Nagarjuna trod are outside his system and are not the means to peace. They debase relative and ultimate truth. With this debased, liberation is unattainable. So unless there is a second gateway to the peace of liberation, such a peace is impossible for those who do not follow his system. Adisha said, how can emptiness be realized? Chandrakriti, disciple of he who was predicted by Tathagata, of he who saw the true suchness of phenomena, Nagarjuna, through his lineage of instruction, you will see the true suchness of phenomena. That is, Acharya Chandrakriti was the best of Nagarjuna's followers. And the thinking, the I, is the mind thinking, the I is a mind or consciousness, and the object of that self-centered feeling is the I, the intrinsic I. Reading from page number 624, the last para. The thoughts of many of these earlier acharyas remained in the Prasangika camp, but the acharyas taught in various ways to suit the mentalities of their disciples, and later many of their followers did not comprehend the true thoughts of these masters and gradually fell into error. There were few authorities on the ultimate version of the view, and Jetsongkhapa, the embodiment of Manjushri, did not trust what most of these other Tibetans were saying about the view. So he set off for the noble land of India to meet Acharya Nagabodhi, the great adept Mitra, and so on. The great adept Lota Namgajanse begged him to abandon his plan, with the adept himself acting as intermediary. Tsongkhapa asked Vajrapani questions on the view. Reading from page 625, Vajrapani's teaching was written down in the form of questions and answers and called the Rosary of Supreme Healing Ambrosia. This teaching made Jirambuchi doubt all the more the views expressed in the books available at that time. He was still completely dissatisfied, and so he made petitions to his guru while regarding him as indivisible from Manjushri. He worked hard and long at building up his accumulations and at purifying himself and pursued a variety of meditation topics. He practiced this intensively and later received the direct vision of Manjushri. In general, there are three types of vision. One is seeing a hallucination of the deity, experience when the energy winds enter the energy channels. There is another type of vision where the deity appears to the mental consciousness, and this type is experienced in meditation. Lastly is the type where one actually sees the deity with one's sense consciousness, man to man as it were. Jirambuchi had this last type of vision of Manjushri and was able to meet Manjushri as a disciple meets his guru. Manjushri's answer to the questions Jirambuchi has put concerning difficult points on the views were too profound. Whenever Jirambuchi did not understand something, he would debate these doubtful points with Randhawa. Yet even this did not clear up all his doubts. Manjushri declared that Tsongkhapa should take his teachings as his starting point, and then if he took pains, he would come to realize the profound and undistorted view by relying on the learned classics. So it came to pass later, by virtue of his stack of accumulations and purification of obscurations, he had the vision of Buddha Palida. He then went through this author's commentary, The Pursuit of Buddhahood, and so the ultimate view of the Prasangika arose in his mind stream. During this period of his life, he had visions of many Indian pundits and adepts but paid scant attention to them. Manjushri told Jarumbache, with the high realized Lama acting as intermediary for the deity, that he should heed these visions, for it would be most beneficial for others and himself if he were to depend on this masterpiece. Sorry, we are changing.
Jhangir Rabe Dorje says that, so what is said here by Pabongka Rinpoche is the same as what Jhangir Rabe Dorje has said, that some youth or young students of our tradition with regard to the object of negation, when you try to establish and prove emptiness, they use these terms such as standalone existence and so forth. But when they actually try to disprove or that independent existence of things, what they do is they still keep intact the solidity of things while try to negate or disprove the inherent existence. So this is not getting at the right point of refuting this object of negation. So Jhangir Rinpoche says, with regards to this identifying the object of negation, you do not need to look for it somewhere else. It is right here within you. First key point, what is to be refuted. And the second key point is determining the full set of possibilities. And as we have just heard above, a correct mental image born of first-hand experience of the object to be refuted may appear clearly to the mind's eye. If such an eye, the thing being instinctively grasped at, were in fact established by its nature, it would necessarily be established as being either one with or different from the basis of imputation, the aggregates. There is no third possibility other than these two. In general, if a phenomenon exists, it must necessarily be singular or plural. If this is the full set of possibilities for a category, And if something is proved to be whole category, then when an instance of that category exists truly, it must necessarily be either truly singular or truly plural. It is quite certain that this covers all cases. If there is, it therefore also applies to such an I, which can only be either the same as the aggregates or separate from them. The key point of this is it should lead you to certainty that if it is neither of these two, it cannot exist. You must meditate on this point, this key point, not merely for a day or two, but until you gain unshakable conviction in it. And that the third key point, determining that they are not truly the same. Begin by bringing to mind the mode of existence of the thing to be refuted. Apply this to the way the self and aggregates appear. If they were established as one, they would not appear separately to the mind. They must be one, never divisible into separate components. The reason is that things that have the same entity can appear to mind as separate from one another, but this discordance between the way they appear and their actual mode of existence is a deceptive way of relative truth. Such would not be acceptable if they were established as true. The way it appears would have to correspond with the way it exists. Consequently, it would be pointless to posit a self, to say the self's aggregates would not be different from saying the aggregates or self the self's self. It would be pointless to make the distinction between the self and the self's aggregates. Nagarjuna, as the root of wisdom, says, when you determine that it is not so, that the self exists apart from the appropriated aggregates, if the appropriated aggregates are the self, your proposed self would not exist. In other words, the flaw in such an argument is that there would be no appropriator, the self, that is different from the five appropriated aggregates, as if it were not enough. It says in the engaging in the middle way, it is not right to argue the appropriator and the appropriated are one, for then the doer and the deed would be one. In other words, such an argument is absurd because the receiver and the thing appropriated would be one. The body and the embodied being would be one. The limbs and the creature with the limbs would be one. Further, if the self and the aggregates were one, then, as it says in the engaging in the middle way, if the aggregates were the self, it follows that as there are many, the self too would be multiple. In other words, just as there are five aggregates, the self would also be five in number. Another absurd consequence would be that there is only one self. One could not accommodate five aggregates. There would have to be one as well. As the self is supposed to be the five aggregates, we have the absurdity that it would be meaningless to talk of conception in the mother's womb. Further, as the I and the body are supposed to be the same entity by nature and the body is cremated after death, becoming ash, we have the absurdity that the I is cremated at the same time and also turns to ash. And we have further absurdities. When the I goes into next rebirth, the body would be conceived at the time of conception. So, since that body will not be so conceived, the I will not be conceived in the next rebirth either. It would not be possible for such a self to be reborn in the formless realm. The self would be matter. If the eye and the mind were one, it would be impossible for the eye to feel or cold or hunger because the mind does not get cold or feel hungry. The absurd consequence would be that one could not say, I am cold or I am hungry, when one is hot, cold, hungry, thirsty, and so on. If if both the body and the mind were the I, it would be pointless to make any distinction between my body and my mind. Furthermore, if the self and the aggregates were established from their own side as being one thing, then their location, time, and everything about them would have to be the same. So, it says in the roots of the wisdom, if the aggregates were the self, it would be thing produced and destroyed. In other words, just as the aggregates are produced and cease to be, the self would also be produced and cease. Thus, just as the form aggregates has past and future discontinuities and is in this sense produced and destroyed, so the self would also have its continuity broken, and the absurd consequence is that it too would be produced and destroyed if the I reborn. In one's other rebirths and the aggregates of each past and future rebirths were by nature the same entity, and the past rebirth and I of this present rebirth would be either the same or different. If these eyes were the same, it would have to experience in this present rebirth the sufferings of being dumb and stupid that one had in one's past rebirth as animals. Another consequence is that the animal in that past rebirth would have to experience the happiness that is a lot of a human being. But if the I of the previous life were naturally separate from the I of the future rebirths, then, as it says in Engaging in the Middle Way, the qualities related to Maitreya and Upagupta are different and thus not included in the same continuum. It is not right to include things having individual characteristics under the one continuity. In other words, the absurd consequence is that argument cannot accommodate the clairvoyant power of being able to remember many of one's past lives, because these lives would have to be as separate and naturally unrelated as Maitreya and Upagupta, who have different mind streams from the root wisdom. It says, in the root wisdom, if their past I were different, without it, it would arise. Further, the past I would remain or be reborn or not die, and it would absurdly follow that on the annihilation of the past self, karma would dissipate, and the karma done by one being would be individually experienced by other, and so on. That is, the disappearance of karma that had already been committed is one fault in the argument. You may then wonder, wouldn't the self of a subsequent rebirth experience karmic result even though the self of the past rebirth had been discarded? If this were so, these absurdities would follow. A person established by nature would experience the result of karma accumulated by another person who is also established by his nature. This is tantamount to meeting with something for which the karma has not been committed, and so on. You have determined that the self and the aggregates are not truly of the same when you are convinced that there's absolutely no way to establish the self and the aggregates as being established by nature as one. And then the fourth key point, determining that they are not truly different. Now that you are certain that that they are not the same, you should feel all that remains is for the self and the aggregates to be established as separate by nature. If they were shown to be naturally separate, then, as it says in the root of wisdom, we cannot accept that the self is different from the appropriated aggregates. If these were different, they would be rightly perceived without the appropriated, but it is not so perceived. In other words, when you eliminate the goat and sheep from a group of a group consisting of sheep and goat, a sheep, a goat, a bull, you are able to point to the remaining animal and say, there is the bull. You must similarly be able to identify something that is unconnected with the aggregates called the I. which would be the residue after eliminating each of the five aggregates, form, feeling, recognition, some compositional factors, and consciousness. But you do not, in fact, come to identify such a thing. It says in Root of Wisdom, if it were different from the aggregates, it would not have the characteristics of aggregates. That is, the self would not have the production, cessation, etc. that are the characteristics of conditioned phenomena. Also, although the aggregates are bone, age, and die, the self would not be bone, age, or die, and so on. Anything that affects the aggregates would neither hurt nor harm the self. These examples contradict common sense, and there are many other contradictions. One would still have a sense of an I without its aggregate basis. Previously committed karma would disappear. There would also follow the absurdity that I have already mentioned of one's meeting with something which for which the karma had not been committed, and so on. The point about this process of determining that the self and the aggregates are not truly different is for you to become convinced that they are definitely not established as being separate by nature. Thus, while recalling the way in which the thing you have determined to be the object of refutation appears to you, examine this object by means of the above arguments that it is neither the same nor different from the aggregates. The sort of conviction you gain, which totally refutes these two, is illustrated as follows. Suppose you have lost a bull, and there are only two valleys for it to go to. The mere word, "There is no bull in this valley," would not satisfy you, and you would seek the bull from top to middle to bottom of the two valleys. When you do not find it, an involuntary feeling will arise within you that the sought-after bull you had set your mind on is not there. Similarly, this I, the object clung to by your instinctive self-grasping, seemed until now like something that could be seen by the eye or touched by the hand. When the vivid thought arises that it is not there, when it becomes completely empty, when you decidedly determine that it does not exist, you have found the Madhyamaka view. At this point, the sharp-witted, owing to their great familiarity with the subject, feel they have discovered something precious. The dull-witted become afraid because they have suddenly lost a most cherished thing. This, however, does no harm. Once, while Jenambucha was giving a discourse on the view in Sedachunding Hermitage, Sherib Sangye realized the view and became afraid, grabbing the collar of his monk's shirt. Jenambucha understood what had happened, and this made him happy. The fellow from Narthang, Jenambucha said, had discovered relative truth on his collar. There's also a story about Ngulchu Thome Sangpo. When he gave a discourse on the view, some of the disciples became terrified. When the eye becomes completely empty, you may get ideas of, "This is emptiness. I have realized it." In this case, neither the negation having further implications or an outright affirmation is coming to mind, and you should not be misled. If instead you are sure that I, the object of refutation, does not exist, your understanding should have two features. You have the conviction and confidence in the non-existence of by nature of certainty, of the certainty that I, the object of such a refutation, definitely does not exist. And for what is appearing to you at the time, there should be a complete emptiness, that is, the mere negation of there being any establishment of this object of refutation as being true. Retain this certainty without forgetting it and always pursue it. If your retention of this certainty weakens and begins to become unclear, it may not be necessary to arise from your meditative absorption. According to circumstances, in any case, resume your analysis by means of the four key points, as you did before. On discovering this certainty, increase its vividness. Then enter single-pointed absorption. while this vividness lasts, while you are in this meditative absorption, a complete emptiness presents itself to you, resembling space. This emptiness is merely the negation of the establishment of object of refutation as being something true. This is the way you pursue the sky-like absorption. At this point, by virtue of refuting the self, the object of refutation, the conventional I will be blocked. When you do not find it, however, have no fears that you have fallen into a nihilistic view. You must not tire yourself looking for the conventional I. When not in absorption, how to pursue the attitude that things are like an illusion? After rising from this meditative absorption, when you examine what is left among the remnants of the negation of the objects to be refuted, So what is refuted, what is left after refuting the negation of the object of negation, doing this while not in absorption, all that seems to remain is the mere I. This is merely the conventional I. Always bear in mind the certainty that this is what accumulates virtuous and non-virtuous karmas as if an illusion, and then that on this type of I will ripen such black or white karmic results. An illustration, although the illusion of horses and elephants appear to the conjurer, he is certain in his own mind that these horses and elephants do not exist. Thus, while he is sure that their appearance is quite false, he undeniably actually sees the agents and actions, the horses and elephants coming and going, and so forth. As in our example, the I, something imputed as a mere label by, and not naturally existent, nonetheless accumulates karma and experiences happiness and sorrow, although it is not something true. Thus, you see, you can accommodate the fact that the I performs actions through its undeniable interdependent origination, and yet, though it appears to you, it is still empty. Though it is empty, it presents itself to you like an illusion. This is how you train yourself. When we seek the view for the first time, it is difficult for us to accept emptiness in our mind's eye because of our great familiarity with clinging to true existence. But later, it becomes harder for us to accept that appearance of things. As Nagarjuna said, the peerless Tathagata taught this, all functional things are empty by nature. Therefore, functional things are to interdependent origination. Dependent origination. In other words, the being empty serves as the reason for the interdependent origination of things. Their emptiness implies that they can also appear to us, to you, without dependent origination serving as a reason. Interdependence of things, or dependence of things, must also imply their emptiness for you. The formal logic involving mutual dependence has great importance. An example, when one cites mutual dependence as proof that a sprout, for example, does not have true existence, it must refute the way one instinctively grasps at an object, here the sprout, as if it existed in its own right and were not merely something assumed by virtue of having a name applied to it. So with regards to the analytical meditation and focusing meditation, so when you develop the union of calm abiding and emptiness with regard to an object which is emptiness, the stability of the mind on the object emptiness is brought about by the analytical mind through the force of the analysis. Such a refutation goes as follows. If, as we perceive, the sprout were established by its nature, it would not be dependent on other things, such as its cause, as causes or circumstances, nor would it be something assumed through labeling. It would have to be something isolated, but this is not in fact so. It grows owing to the set of causes and conditions, the seed, water, manure, warmth, moisture, and so on. This proves that it is established in dependence on other things and is their outcome. This is something we can actually observe by ourselves. Thus, the sprout is an example of independent origination. Such arguments and reasonings concerning dependent origination refute the extreme view that things are established by their own nature as being independent of anything else and as being self-sufficient. So, through appearance, we are rid of extreme of view of substantialism. Thus, dependent origination implies emptiness. If the seedling were established by its own nature, no cause or circumstance could alter it in any way. The nature of the seedling would necessarily not change into something else. But because it is not established by its own nature, when it has gone beyond the stage of being a sprout, it will eventually grow into a stalk and will grow other intervening stages as well until it is barley. It is barley and is consumed by humans and animals. This will lead you to the conviction that the presentation of dependent origination accommodates all such functionality and that this is emptiness eliminating. Nihilism and emptiness arising as dependent origination. Thoughts on these matters may be found in the sutra requested by Anavatapta, where it says, anything produced through circumstances is not produced. It does not have the nature of production. Anything that is an outcome of circumstances is empty. He who understands emptiness is rigorous. Or heedful. In the root of wisdom we find, since there are no phenomena that exist, that does not independently originate, there are not dependent originated, there are no phenomena that exist that is not empty. It is said in engaging a middle way, addressing an opponent, because functional things arise dependently. Your conceptions do not bear scrutiny. Thus, the logic of a dependent origination cuts through the network of wrong views. Also, Jetsongkhapa says, perceiving that these two merely go together, that they are not alternatives, and that mutual interdependence of undeceptive destroys all the ways in which you grasp at objects with the mind. At this point, you perfect your analysis of the view. You eliminate the extreme of specious substantialism. You eliminate the extreme of empty nihilism. If you understand how emptiness presents itself as cause and effect, views that grasp extremes will not impress you. Sorry. If you gain some uncertainty into how emptiness and dependent origination do not contradict each other, but rather imply each other, you will complement each other, you will understand the mutual independence of actions and agents, cause and effect, and so on. You will value emptiness and dependent origination all the more. You will reject sin and practice virtue. You will have compassion, bodhicitta, and will carry on any advice associated with the practice, thus striving in a practice that lacks neither method nor wisdom. Some people do not do this and instead take cause and effect to be of value only for beginners, while singling out certain instructions for their disciples to follow. Such teachings without cause and effect are not much different from those of Tirthika hedonist school, the Lokayata. Asserting the non-existence of a self of phenomena. This has two sections. Asserting the conditioned phenomena do not naturally exist. Asserting that unconditioned phenomena do not naturally exist. Yes. Certainly that conditioned phenomena do not intrinsically exist. The subsections are, for this are the ascertainment that physical things do not have internal existence, the ascertainment that consciousness does not inherently exist, the ascertainment that non-associated compositional factors do not inherently exist. Ascertaining that physical do not, the first one, you should, regarding the first one, you should readily apply other phenomena, certainly. Apply to other phenomena the certainty you have gained into the fact that, as we saw above, a person is not established by its own nature. In a sutra, it says, so apply to all the same attitude you have for the self. His Holiness is asking whether the tea has come or not. So people down there have not yet got tea. Aryadeva says in the 400 verses, the view that holds one for is the view that holds for other. Or any emptiness that holds for one is an emptiness that holds for all. So first of all, we are certain that the things do not have intrinsic existence. The consciousness that lie within the mental stream of us ordinary beings have been affected by ignorance. And when physical things and so forth appear to us, their mode of appearance is none other than that of seeming to be established in their own right. This appearance is the way the object to be refuted appears. And we must refute such appearances of their supposedly being established in this way. All phenomena are examples of independent origination. That is, the label is merely, put upon some basis of imputation, which itself depends upon other components, each with its own basis of imputation. Take the case of a pot, which we had before. To the consciousness of ordinary beings who have not achieved the view, the pot does not appear to be merely a phenomenon imputed or on the basis of some basis of that imputation. Instead, the basis of imputation and the imputed phenomena are so inextricably mixed that the pot appears to be something self-apparent and established. Thus, this is the way in which the object to be refuted appears. It may appear in this way, but when you pursue the reasoning that the basis of imputation and the phenomenon imputed are separate, are different, you will find that the pot, which instinctively is being held to be true, cannot be established as being the same as the basis of imputation, which is itself supposed to be established as true. Further, once you apply a process of elimination to the basis of imputation of the pot, what remains does not seem to be a pot that you can point to. Instead, the valid conventional pot appears to you in dependence upon its valid basis of imputation, the mouth, the belly, and the base, and so on. You must assume that the pot exists merely as a conventional truth, because the pot cannot be established as something that is itself established as true and different, separate from the basis of imputation. So, in general, if something exists, it must exist as either single or multiple. Similarly, if it is established as being something true, it can only be single or multiple in a way that can be established as true. If it is neither of these two, it cannot be truly existent. For this reason, pot and so forth cannot be established as being true. In short, extrapolating from the pot, all phenomena, that is, physical things and so forth, must depend on their basis of imputation. They are not established as true and self-sufficient. The 400 verses said, all these are not dependent. The self, therefore, does not exist. And the root of wisdom says, other is other in relation to another. Without another, it could not be other. If other were other than other, it would be other without the other. Certainly, that consciousness does not inherently exist. So the thing we call consciousness is a functional phenomena, an illuminating intelligence. luminous or clear awareness that occupies itself with some object. There is a very long list of primary minds and mental factors. For all of these, there is a part that experiences the entity and the particulars of the object, and a large number of parts, being the past and future moments of consciousness. Apart from the mere conceptual imputation made upon the basis of imputation, the collection of these parts, consciousness is not in the least established on its own part. However, this is not how it appears to us. It presents itself as to us as something quite independent and self-sufficient that independently engages with its object. It is supposed to be something discoverable apart from its object. This is the way in which the object to be refuted presents itself to us. So, if this consciousness were established to exist in the way in which it appears, taking today's consciousness in your own mental stream as our example, it would necessarily be established as being either the same as or separate from its past and future moments in time. If it were established as separate from them, what remains after the elimination of mornings and evenings consciousness should be today's consciousness. On the contrary, they are inseparable. Hence, your consciousness is not established by being truly separate from your past or future consciousness. As for today's consciousness, if both your consciousness this morning and your consciousness in the evening were established as being truly singular, it follows, as these two are multiple, that your consciousness today is also multiple. And as today's consciousness occurred in the morning, it would follow that this evening's consciousness would also occur in the morning. So, or the evening's consciousness does not occur in the morning. So it must also follow that today's consciousness could not have occurred in the morning either, and so on. Hence, your consciousness is not established as truly either one with or different from its components. You must work along these lines in order to gain conviction that it does not truly exist. And the next part is ascertaining that non-associated composition factors do not exist. Then there is also ascertaining that conditioned phenomena do not inherently exist. And then the way you develop special insight. So we have finished quite a bit. So I have some pain in my back. It's perhaps indicating that I should take a break, take a holiday. And so as while the Lama takes a holiday, and you also get holiday. So I'm left with few pages, and I'll read through. So his holiness is reached at a point where it mentions in the text that you should train your mind until the point that you feel that if you put effort, you may be able to have the genuine development of this mind. And therefore, in those who are studying philosophy in with regard to Panchaparamita studies and Madhyamaka studies in these big monastic institutions, you should be able to actually use the knowledge that you gain from these studies so that you are able to take them into the Lamrim practice, as Namshite Jezabje's commentary on Abhisamaya Alamkara instructs us. So right from the beginning, you should be able to make a determination that these study that, that you are doing are for the application in my mind. And therefore, in one sitting, one could carry the whole range of path. And therefore, Jerembuji says, one should please correctly one's teachers. And so the more you find the importance of the teacher, to that extent, you will find that the teacher is precious, valuable to you. So if you want to be a principal of a school, for example, or a king of a place, and one should have the qualifications to hold such a position through study, education, and examinations, and so forth. You cannot just become a principal because you have power or money. And likewise, a spiritual master, as I have been saying before, should have the 10 qualifications mentioned in the Mahayana Sutra Alamkara, Mahayana ornament of Mahayana Sutras, and after giving these qualifications, the Jerembuche says that those who wish to seek spiritual teachers must learn these qualifications and seek your teachers. And similarly, those who wish to have students and disciples must also learn what qualifications are necessary for the disciples and accordingly seek them. And Jerembuche says further that those who wish to discipline others, tame others, cannot do so without being disciplined themselves. And the way to discipline others is by following the teaching of the three trainings, by following the teachings of three trainings. And the study of the classic great texts, and therefore, for a teacher, as a teacher in the schools, need to know the subject that they want to teach in order to be able to teach the students in schools. Here too, the spiritual teacher, someone who wants to be a spiritual teacher, must develop the qualities, criteria, qualifications of a teacher. And here we are not talking about just being a teacher in a school, a secular school, but here we are dealing with how to discipline our mind stream, this unruly mind stream. Therefore, however little you may have the experience, you should develop them within yourselves so that you, teachers in secular schools, where the teacher may be, it may be okay for the teacher just to know the subject and not so much the case that they have to integrate those subjects within themselves. But here, the teachers of Dharma should integrate the teachings within themselves, and the students also should be impartial, intelligent, and also someone who has aspiration to practice. And then in Lamrim Chemo, when it comes to the outline where it says that how the students should rely on the teacher, it mentions the advantages of relying on a teacher and disadvantages of not relying, and then the disadvantage also, or the faults of wrong reliance, and seeing that there are lots of negative consequences from wrongly relying or going against the teacher. So by knowing that if you do not relying on the teacher properly, you should decide that you will rely properly. And for that, you have reliance in thought and in action. And for the first one, you have the development of respect and the faith in the guru. And in the Gyutsang Labm Rim, there are special instructions that are given with regard to these two, and which are brought down in this Lamrim text by Pabongkhapa Rinpoche. So, and then, therefore, you have the reasons why you should see the Lama as Buddha, and that there is possibility for you to be able to see the Lama as Buddha, and so forth, and the Lama as the one who carries out the enlightened deeds of all Buddhas. So because the Lama is the one who gives you the ordination vows up to the monastic ordination vows and up to the Vajrayana vows. And so this is how the Buddhas of the past have served sentient beings. And there's no other way that the Lama could serve or help sentient beings other than this, apart from this way of helping. So someone who is able to carry out the think that when it's needed, the Lama even shows up and assumes the ordinary form to serve sentient beings. And therefore, you can see the Lama to be the one who carries out the enlightened deeds of all Buddhas for us in this degenerate time. And also, we should train our mind with the fact that there is no certainty in our own perception, how we see things. And with regard to the your root lama, you have to develop such attitudes like these, and then the rest of the lamas could be regarded as the manifestations of that root lama. So as we have in the Lama Cherpa, the merit filled, from the heart of the lama comes all the other lineage lamas. And also the deities, protector deities, and so forth. And so so all of these in the visualization, then you can do the practice where you single-pointedly pray to the guru, saying that you are the master, the Buddha, Dharma, and so forth. And so, from the Lama's heart, you can imagine that the rest of the Lamas from whom you have received teachings could be seen as manifestations. And then you have to also think that the Lama is more kind than the kinder to you than all the Buddhas. And for giving teachings and blessing your mind stream and also giving material things. So in this way, you will feel respect to your Lama. So as Lama Chepa says, from the point of view of the kindness of the Guru, your Lama is kinder to you than all the Buddhas. So there's on the one hand, your perception is very unreliable, but because the Lama, on the other hand, because the Lama has assumed an ordinary form for us, we are able to receive teachings directly from if the Lama were to remain in the Dharmakaya or the Sambhogakaya form, even the Arya Bodhisattvas or even ordinary Arya Bodhisattvas will not have access to them, and also the ordinary Bodhisattvas will not have access to Sambhogakaya. So if it were the case that we had been born even as an insect during the time of the Buddha, and we would not be like the where we are now, and there had been great masters like Nagarjuna and his disciples, and the 84 Mahasiddhas and the 17 Nalanda masters. They have done service to the Dharma and sentient beings, leading them to enlightenment, the path of enlightenment. But at this time, when the time is so degenerate, at this degenerate time, the ones who have taken care of us is our gurus. And when we are like a beggars in terms of our dharma practice, and so you have to feel the gratitude, grateful to the lamas, and also follow the lamas' instructions. And not only the if you wish to please the lama, you have to follow his instructions. And from the side of the lama, he or she does not look for gains, material gains, or anything, but give teachings to help the disciples. So in the study of Prajaparamita, also there's mention of the importance of one's guru, but it's not put in a sequential, orderly manner like Lamrim texts do. The bodhicitta is our primary practice, and then the paths shared with the lower and intermediate beings are like preliminary practice to that, and then the rest of the practices like the tantric practices and the six perfections and so forth are the those which entailed by the practice of bodhicitta, the practices. And therefore, from all angles, if you check with regard to this practice of bodhicitta, you'll see the importance of the reliance on guru. So on a daily basis, you should do a screening kind of meditation through the whole range of the path, and then whichever part you are emphasizing on that on a particular day, you should focus more on that, and then carry on with the rest of the practice. So first, do a complete screening of the complete range of the path to enlightenment. So I use Gadanthaji, the 100 deities of Tushita Heaven and others for Guru Yoga or Yoga practice. And also I do visualize and go over the 37 factors of enlightenment and the Four Noble Truths, and then go into the benefit of bodhicitta using Master Nagarjuna's text. And then at one point, do meditation on impermanence and death, and the preciousness and the rarity of finding human life and so forth, and then go into the series of meditations pertaining to bodhicitta, starting with equanimity, developing equanimity, and then going on with recalling all sentient beings as one's mother, and remembering their kindness and so forth, loving kindness and so forth. So those practices with which you have already gained, of which you have gained experience, you should remind them in them within your mind, in your mind. So with regards to the aspirational prayers for Guhyasamaja and Guhyasamaja and Heruka practice, Jerambuja himself has written those prayers. And then with regard to the Yamantaka aspirational prayer, we usually say the prayer written by the second Dalai Lama. So, So, with regards to the ear whispered lineage of Ensapa and also the central lineage from the Ensa tradition of Ensapa comes from the Tsang region, which spread passed down from Ketup Sherep Singhi and Rinchen Losang Shigen and so forth. And then there is the and Ensapa and so forth, and then the central lineage comes from Rinchen Sherep Singhi town. And then after ascertaining that conditioned phenomena do not naturally or inherently exist, then the way you develop special insight comes. And next is how to train in the uncommon path of the path, which is the Vajrayana. As I've already told you, when you have gained some experience of renunciation by means of a small or medium scope, you should then try to experience Bodhicitta through the great scope. You should succeed, then work. Should you succeed, then work toward gaining conviction in the view of emptiness, after which you must enter the secret Tantra Yana. But if you start practicing Tantra without this sort of preparation, it will not act as the means for your liberation or lead you to complete or peerless enlightenment. There is a great risk that Tantra will prove profitless for you and as dangerous as riding an unbroken horse is for a child, a small child. If you gain insight from the three fundamentals of the path and then enter the secret Tantra, you are certain to avail yourself of their unique rapidity. The secret Tantra are said to even to be rarer than the Buddhas. Through this path, you can gain state of normal learning and unification within your short lifetime. Someone is just reading through the caller phone. The final O foremost in the Tathagata's teaching, holder of the Vajra, with the sword of love, you destroy worldly existence. The breadth of your mind was limitless. You furthered the teachings, the best of the victors, good works. You awaken all beings from their benighted sleep, like a moon marked with the ultimate seals of emptiness and compassion, whose springtide filled and ever blissful scenic lake, your light caused the lotus of my mind to open fully. O Lord of all Buddha families, return and once again become my crowning jewel. O Protector, your very word, precious one, 100,000 times, quenched the desire for the world or selfish peace. Here are my siblings, a strong box of your instructions. Scribblings, a strong box of your instructions. May the fortunate hold your words to be the most precious in their hearts. You display Tsongkhapa's multi-level doctrine. You embody the refutation of those against omniscience. Through the peerless glory of your realizations and teachings, you led us through supreme vehicle according to the level of our wits. All the sages, scriptures are supreme, as jewel for us embodied beings. The mind that realizes these supreme instructions regard whatever appears as the revelation of the guru. This practice is a path pleasing to the victors. Pabongka Dorje Chang, master of all energies, is a unique embodiment and distillation of the omniscient love, power, and good works of all the victorious ones of the three times and their children. His inconceivably skillful deeds, motivated by his love, turned dullards such as myself, into beings fortunate enough to practice the supreme vehicle. This was the incomparable kindness of our guru, whose ordination name I shall now give. In view of my purpose, Jambil Denzin Chinde Gyatso Pe Sangpo, he gave this teaching at the request of Yangzom Tsering, wife of master of Lalu Gatsil, estate and aristocrat, but a lady of unequaled faith. She made this request in order to increase the root merits of two departed members of the blood, Jigme Namgyel and Pinzo Rabgyel. It was given in the Iron Bird year of the 1560-year cycle, 1921, in the debate courtyard of Chusang Hermitage in Nyangten. It brought together three teachings concerning the stages of the path to enlightenment, the concise teaching called the Swift Path, the two lineages that developed from Manjushri's own words, one from the central province and one from the south. It also included a section on the seven-point mind training. He gave this informal but profound teaching out of his supreme kindness. So by this, long may the precious teaching of the stages of the path to enlightenment stay with us. May they flourish and spread in all directions for all time. So there's going to be a talk offering, and I also have to make an announcement for the Westerners that we would have a So His Holiness, just for your information, His Holiness is saying that in the next 3 days we may be able to complete the rest of the two texts. And on the 29th, by 29th I may be able to complete, and there we'll have a break in between the Slum Rim teaching. And in the morning of 29th, presided over by the Gadantur Rinpoche, the former abbots and also the teachers of philosophy in the various monastic institutions, and we'll have a meeting. And then the people from Western countries I will try to see you, and then in the afternoon, perhaps we'll see whether there is time or not for meeting with Asians, the foreigners. And then on the 30th and 31st, we'll have the 16 drops of Gadam initiation. So on that day, on the and then on the New Year day of the Western calendar, we'll have the long life Tenshuk offering for His Holiness, and then I will give the White Thara initiation, long life initiation. And so since we are about to finish this thing, those who have come from Garden and Drepung, please start packing your things up.